Today is Monday, April 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, a deadly explosion on a Russian subway train. We have the latest for you. The U.S. president says the United States is prepared to take unilateral action to eliminate the nuclear threat posed by North Korea if China does not increase pressure. His U.N. ambassador agrees.
At some point, we need to see definitive actions by China condemning North Korea.
So also ahead, one group is trying to mitigate the effect of short attention span. It's all on today's International Edition. We start International Edition from Russia, where authorities say at least 10 people have been killed and 50 others injured in an explosion on the metro system in the city of St. Petersburg. Russian media reported that the blast took place at the Sinaia Square metro station in the city center. Joining us from Moscow is reporter Charles Maines. Charles, what do we know so far about what happened and why?
Well, we know a couple things. We know that this explosion occurred between two stations. There were initial reports that indicated a second explosion in a neighboring station. That appears now to have been just smoke carryover from the initial blast. Police say they've also found another, even stronger bomb at a third central station, but that failed to detonate. Video and pictures from the scene show the doors of a metro wagon twisted outwards. The explosion clearly destroying the inside of the car and ripping into passengers. You saw stunned people lying about, seemingly either dead or injured. Emergency services launched a massive evacuation mission into the metro. It's one of the deepest in the world, so it wasn't easy to get people out. So there was a mass evacuation of passengers. Metro is now closed until tomorrow. We have heightened security at the metro in Moscow as well. And of course, the wounded are being evacuated and taken care of in local hospitals.
Has this been called terrorism as yet?
Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin was actually in St. Petersburg today. This morning, he was at a forum for media and pro-Kremlin media. This was a planned event. He's actually meeting and, in fact, meeting at this moment with the leader of Belarus, his Belarusian counterpart, Alexander Lukashenko. He made a statement to the press expressing condolences, saying that expressing condolences to the families and friends of those killed in this explosion. He also said he'd spoken with security officials here, and investigators were considering all explanations, including terrorism. But it's important to note that the investigative committee here in Moscow has opened a case in under the terrorism file, although they say that they're looking at other versions. But certainly this points to this idea that terrorism is their primary theory at this point.
And who might be suspect of this? Who is not getting along with the Russian government of late?
Well, the list is long, but what we know is this. The authorities here have released some video surveillance footage of a man they say is a suspect in this by outward appearances. This was released online. It would appear certainly to Russians as someone resembling someone from the Northern Caucasus region, a bearded man wearing a traditional Northern Caucasus hat, although I should point out that there are many, many ethnic groups down in the Caucasus, and so to say exactly who this might be, we have no idea. And again, he's just a suspect. But if you look at it, Russia is no stranger to terrorism, both in the metro. If we go back to 2010, for example, we had explosions ripped through the Moscow metro, killed over 30 people. That was claimed by the leader of an Islamic insurgency in the Russian Republic of Chechnya. But many in Petersburg, of course, will be thinking of the downing of the Metrojet airliner over the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. That was brought down by an explosive device. And ISIS, the Islamic State, claimed responsibility for that attack. That was in October of 2015. At the time, Islamic State said this was revenge for Russia's military air campaign in Syria. Of course, President Putin entered into the Syrian conflict a little over a year and a half ago, ostensibly justifying the move, saying that he was taking the fight to many terrorists from an Islamic terrorist from the Russian Federation, from the Northern Caucasus, in fact, who'd gone over to Syria to fight along ISIS. And Mr. Putin argued that the better move was to take the fight to them in Syria rather than have them fight them at home.
From your personal observation so far in Moscow and what you've been able to gather probably from Russian media, what seems to be the reaction of Russian people to this?
Well, it's mixed. I think, of course, first of all, there's horror because the carnage is significant. Nobody likes to see this. And certainly St. Petersburg is, you know, the second most important city in Russia. So this really strikes to Russians' identity, I think, as a people. On the other hand, I think there's a lot of skepticism over the timing of this. Russians are no strangers to conspiracy theories. And certainly we've seen a lot of chatter online and blogs and elsewhere about what this might mean. I mean, for example, if you look at just a week ago, we had these massive anti-Kremlin protests spring up across the country. These were led by the opposition leader Alexei Navalny in an anti-corruption drive against the Kremlin. Many thought that really the numbers that came out for that event really struck, really caught the Kremlin off guard. And there was some talk even back then that the Kremlin might look for some way to kind of reinforce support for the government. Certainly, there are many who point to the history of Vladimir Putin's rise in Russian politics from the very beginning. There's never substantiated allegations that he was somehow the security services with Mr. Putin's involvement were behind a series of apartment bombings back in 1999. And we're talking about 18 years ago. And of course, these allegations were never proven, but it's never quite left the scene, this idea that somehow the government might, exploit these events for their own use. And already we've had calls from members of the Duma to heighten not only security measures, but anti-terrorism measures. And of course, these anti-terrorism laws have also been used to squeeze members of the opposition and other groups who otherwise don't see eye to eye with the Kremlin.
Charles Mayans reporting for VOA from Moscow. Charles, thanks so much. As we continue on International Edition, we welcome again Andrew Palshevsky. How is this story playing up as far as social media is concerned?
A lot of confusion. A lot of confusion in the aftermath as far as the number of bombs, where they went off. For a time, there was talk about two different explosions. We've since learned it's just one explosion. Talk of a second bomb being found, which some news agencies are reporting. And then the death toll and number of dead. Several news agencies here in the U.S. are reporting 11 dead now, but there's been some fluctuation and back and forth on that. So a lot of confusion. We're seeing, as we see, unfortunately, when these attacks happen, a lot of on-the-scene video, people passing through the metro stations, the smoke-filled stations, photos of people on the ground injured or killed. But we're also seeing some positive use for social media. And this is actually something else we've seen in similar attacks. People are opening up their homes to try to welcome in people who are stranded. So they're using hashtag Domoy, which is the Russian word for home. People are putting their information out there on social media saying, I have a spot in my house. I can put someone up if they can't get home because the metro system is shut down.
That is a good use.
Yeah, you know, so people are using it for
some,
positive.
We don't talk about all that many positives from social media, but they do have it.
No, this is absolutely a positive. It's something that people are trying to help their fellow men and women. There's a lot of anger, too, though, about the lack of coverage on U.S. Cable and news networks, a perceived lack of coverage and perceived bias against Russia. A lot of people wondering why this isn't getting the same attention as other attacks. Now, part of that is because much of the TV coverage today here in the U.S. is on another story that's trending, which is the vote in the Senate Judiciary Committee to advance the nomination of Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. So we're seeing a lot of talk about that, how senators are voting in the committee, and then when it goes to a full Senate vote, will there be a filibuster? Will the vote get blocked? And just like we saw a few weeks ago with the health care bill, we're seeing a lot of activists use social media to galvanize, to contact their senators, urging them to vote for or against this confirmation. So again, we're seeing social media activism around this confirmation hearing, and something I think we're going to see more and more frequently as far as legislative agenda items are concerned.
The situation as far as the vote for or against Gorsuch is concerned, and again, this is a domestic U.S. story, and it I don't know how many people overseas, except for expatriates who are listening, are really all that interested in it, but nevertheless, do people seem to understand the intricacies of how the vote works and how it could work?
Well, that's the great thing about social media, too, is that you, in some cases, like Twitter, you only have 140 characters to explain these things. So you have to be very succinct and kind of hit the bullet points. And with social media stretching around the world, people can access this and learn about this no matter where they are. So it's actually, I think, helping to spread information about the confirmation hearing, kind of dissect some of the intricacies, explain some of the intricacies about what this vote is, how the filibuster works. all of these minute details in our government system. So in that regard, people are interested in it. They are talking about it and they are learning.
How about North Korea? Anything?
Always talk about North Korea on social media with their latest provocations. Always concerned about what they're going to do next. And a lot of people talking about President Trump and what they think he'll do next as a response to what they've said.
Well, that is our next story. That's what it's all about. Thank you, Andrew Palaszewski. We'll talk again tomorrow. Because just days before his first summit with the Chinese President Xi Jinping, President Trump told the Financial Times on Sunday the United States is prepared to take unilateral action to eliminate the nuclear threat posed by North Korea if China does not increase pressure on its Asian ally. Trump said China has great influence over North Korea, and if they help, it'll be a good thing for Beijing. If not, he added, it won't be good for anyone. An administration policy review on North Korea is reportedly complete, and it is said to include sanctions to cut Pyongyang out of the global financial system, including secondary penalties aimed at Chinese banks and companies. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, made similar comments about China in appearances Sunday on U.S. television.
China has to cooperate. This is now down to, do we want to continue to see these ballistic missile attacks from North Korea, or does China want to do something about it? And this is all about the fact that they need to have action. And we're going to continue to put pressure on China to have action. That will be shown in multiple ways. But what we are going to do is say, China, you know that you're the only one that's doing this. We appreciate that you stopped coal going into North Korea, but we know it's going in other ways. At some point, we need to see definitive actions by China condemning North Korea and not just calling them out for it.
Haley's comments come amid reports that Pyongyang is about to conduct a sixth nuclear test. RAND Corporation analyst Bruce Bennett told VOA's Victor Beatty that Trump's remarks represent a change in policy from the previous Obama administration.
The Obama administration has had the opportunity to do secondary sanctions against Chinese businesses working with North Korea for a year roughly now, and only acted, as I understand it, against one Chinese company. I think President Trump is now saying that he's prepared to act against many Chinese companies unless the Chinese do a better job of policing up the sanctions themselves. And we know that the Chinese have not. The Chinese declared a coal import cutoff from North Korea in February, and since that time, there have been many reports of ships pulling into Chinese ports with coal on them from North Korea. So China's not been doing a very good job of policing the sanctions.
As you know, China has indicated it has very little leverage on North Korea.
Well, it has very little leverage if it's unwilling to apply it, which is part of the problem. Now, we don't know the extent to which that is the government telling people to do something, but then bribery getting the importers around it, or what's causing the difficulty. But we know that trade is still flowing in areas that are supposed to be prohibited, according to the Chinese government, and they haven't taken that action yet. And that doesn't mean they will stop North Korea's missile launches, but it will certainly hurt North Korea if they do.
The comments by Mr. Trump to the Financial Times come as Reuters reports that his national security aides have completed a policy review on North Korea that may mix military activity with heightened sanctions that may also incorporate targets against Chinese banks and businesses that do most business with Pyongyang.
So the latter part, the banks and the businesses in China, would be the secondary sanctions. So according to the congressional action taken last year, if companies in China do business with North Korea, then we can tell them that they are not allowed to do business with the United States. So they have to choose between the U.S. and North Korea. That's probably going to be pretty compelling to many Chinese banks and companies to cut off their activity with North Korea, but the president has to specifically designate them.
Bruce Bennett said while China does not react well to pressure, it may have already discussed the tougher sanctions with the U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who spoke by telephone Sunday with the Chinese State Councilor Yang Jiesher about the summit and issues of bilateral and regional importance. Among the top stories in the world, an explosion on a subway car in Russia's second-largest city proves fatal. Comments by the U.S. president open questions about the future U.S. policy toward North Korea. President Trump's son-in-law travels to Iraq, apparently on official business. Egypt's president visits the White House. And the U.S. Senate is facing key votes this week over President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Judge Neil Gorsuch. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition on VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers recently discovered an asteroid that is traveling in an orbit that is the exact opposite of 99.9% of all the planets and asteroids in our solar system. Jupiter shares its orbital path with 6,000 asteroids called Trojan asteroids. All are rotating in the same direction. The Wrong Way asteroid, dubbed 2015 BZ509, or just BZ for short, also shares Jupiter's orbit too, but it travels in an orbit like a car going down the wrong way of a busy one-way street. You would think that BZ would have been smashed to bits by now by the solar system's largest planet. But a new study shows the wayward rock has been able to safely maintain its odd travel path thanks to Jupiter's gravitational influence, which helps it to weave in and out of danger's way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We continue on International Edition and tell you what's happening with this Gorsuch hearing. In fact, they're voting right now, is the Senate, at least the Senate committee. The U.S. Senate is facing a string of key votes this week over the president's Supreme Court nominee, Judge Neil Gorsuch. Democratic opposition to the conservative 49-year-old jurist is mounting, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is vowing that one way or another, Gorsuch will be confirmed in the coming days to fill the ninth seat on the Supreme Court, left vacant by the death more than a year ago of Justice Antonin Scalia, a conservative stalwart on the court for three decades. A Senate panel is expected to approve Gorsuch today, sending the nomination to the full Senate for consideration, where three Democrats have joined all 52 Republicans in supporting his nomination. However, Senate consideration of the nomination is setting the stage for a bruising partisan battle that could forever alter how the chamber operates and further erode already fractious relations between Democrat and Republican lawmakers. So we will be watching that throughout the day for you. You have apps, and you have an Android cell phone? Well, those apps on your smartphone are apparently mining your personal information. That according to a new study. The study done by researchers at Virginia Tech is the first to study how apps talk to one another and trade information, according to a news release. Researchers say that there are two kinds of threats, malware and apps that simply allow for collusion and privileged escalation. They add that in the latter group, they can't measure whether the developer intentionally created security breaches. They describe a leaking scenario saying, for example, that a flashlight app could work with a receiver app to reveal information like your contacts or your information. The team of researchers looked at more than 100,000 apps from Google Play, as well as about 10,000 malware apps over the past 3 years. This is VOA News. In the U.S., people often measure success as 15 minutes of fame or a blockbuster financial quarter. Well, the focus on short-term results doesn't always build the skills needed to solve long-term problems such as how to reduce disease outbreaks or how to maintain species diversity. Concerns about the nation's short attention span have prompted some visionaries to create a playfully serious way to think ahead. From San Francisco, Shelley Schlender reports about the Long Now Foundation.
The designers of this enormous device call it the Long Now Clock. The $42 million timepiece will stand 150 meters high. It will tick only once each year, go bong once a century, and once a millennium, it will send out a cuckoo. Its creators plan for it to last at least 10,000 years, but they're not doing it just to build a better clock.
The goal of the Long Now Foundation is fundamentally to kind of foster long-term responsibility and think about the future in much deeper terms.
Alexander Rose is executive director of the Long Now Foundation. He calls the Long Now clock an icon of long-term thinking.
There are certain problems such as climate change or education or things like that could only be solved if you're thinking on a multi-generational or even longer time frame. And Long Now, the idea of Long Now was to show some examples of projects on that scale.
The black-footed ferret is a focus for one of those projects. The Long Now's Revive and Restore is exploring how to genetically modify this endangered species' DNA to resist plague. Revive and Restore is also pulling together scientists and ecologists to look at extinct animals, such as the woolly mammoth.
To figure out not only what species we could do, but what species we should do that would actually be helpful for the environment.
The Long Now's Rosetta Project has created metal discs that hold 13,000 pages representing over 1,000 languages. The microscopic language pages are readable under a microscope. The solid nickel discs are designed to last thousands of years to preserve disappearing languages, such as Native Arapaho. The Long Now also sponsors talks and podcasts with visionaries such as Dr. Larry Brilliant. The physician and epidemiologist is a former hippie and current philanthropist who helped the World Health Organization eradicate smallpox. The talks inspired the audience.
Eventually, I want to make a difference in the world.
As for pessimists who warn, what's the point of thinking 10,000 years ahead when the world might not survive another 10 months?
Makes you wonder, but you've always got to keep your eye on the future or else you'll be stuck. And you can't get anything done if you're stuck.
By helping people care, dream, and do, the Long Now Foundation plans to make a better world for a long time into the future. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in San Francisco.
That's going to wrap up this program for us. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. You can like us on Facebook now. Make that VOA Now on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for being with us. Our thanks to Director Patrice Martin, the guy pushing the buttons, Daniel Crafton. Thanks to him. I'm Myra Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For people living in former conflict zones, war may not end for years after the last shot has been fired and the peace agreement is signed. For example, landmines and unexploded munitions, remnants of the war between the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia and the Colombian government, stand in the way of post-accord stabilization and reconstruction and inhibit long-term development. They render millions of hectares of land unusable, preventing farmers from tending their fields and herders from pasturing their cattle. In too many countries, ordinary travel is dangerous because roads are lined with minefields and a misstep could cost a passerby his or her life. Everyday activities like gathering wood or forest fruits, hauling produce to the market, or even taking a shortcut through the fields are fraught with danger. Too many children have lost their lives and limbs chasing a stray soccer ball into a minefield. That is why every April 4th we observe the United Nations International Day for Mine Awareness and Assistance in Mine Action. The observance is meant to not only remind us that dangers linger long after the conflict is done, but also to detail all the steps taken by the international community to eliminate the threat of landmines and explosive remnants of war. The United States is working closely with the international community to address this serious humanitarian challenge, which puts innocent people, including many children, at risk, said State Department Acting Spokesperson Mark Toner. Since 1993, the United States has provided over $2.8 billion in assistance for conventional weapons destruction programs in some 95 countries. These programs produce tangible, measurable, positive results by providing the expertise and equipment to safely clear landmines and other unexploded ordnance, and to assist landmine accident survivors with rehabilitation and reintegration, said spokesperson Toner. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson underlined the essential role that demining plays in stabilization in Iraq and Syria as civilians seek to return home to areas liberated from ISIS, he said. On this day of mine awareness, we urge other nations to join us in a robust international partnership with the shared goal of reducing the impact of landmines around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.